my operators on this asked me to record it. So for the past 2 years, we've been conducting participant observation fieldwork on a block in the Puerto Rican section of North Philadelphia, where two members of my ethnographic team, George Carandinos in the middle and Fernando Montero on the left, reside. And the fourth person of the team is Lori Hart, my partner. Right from the beginning, the social networks we initiate, and that's the apartment that George and Fernando live in. Right from the beginning, the social networks we befriended made it clear to us that violence is not a deviant act. We learned that it operates within overlapping moral economies of reciprocal obligations and gendered, kin-inflected, and hierarchical cross-generational expectations. It also operates within a negative set of generally abusive relationships with law enforcement and public policy. The ability to mobilize violence is a valuable resource in our scene. On the one hand, it is an instrumental necessity within the drug trade, which is the most accessible and lucrative source of local employment. On the other hand, it circulates as a reciprocal obligation of mutual solidarity within social networks. A moral economy of violence also drives everyday law enforcement activities, which most directly impact the daily lives of inner city residents. Nearly every family on our block has been directly impacted by incarceration. The majority of the men on our block have been to jail or prison at least once, some for over a decade. Many, if not most, have also been physically abused or verbally insulted by the police. Finally, one can argue that the larger punitive neoliberal policies respond to these moral economies of violence, fueling more rounds of structural violence with the kinds of policies we've instituted since the 1980s towards the poor. Okay, now I'm going to begin with some fieldwork notes from George Carandinos. Loud yelling makes me glance out the window just in time to see a frail middle-aged heroin addict slam into the side of my parked car. He is reeling from a punch to his jaw from Roland, one of my 22-year-old neighbors. Alfredo, a gangling 15-year-old who lives two doors down from me, jumps on the fallen man, kicking him in the side and the chest. Sol, Roland's mother, is shouting now, loud enough for everyone on the block to hear. No one is going to disrespect me here. I live here. If anyone disrespects me, there will be consequences. If it's a woman, I will resolve it myself. If it's a man, my son will. Everybody on the block now knows that Sol's son, Roland, is a genuine rider, someone who is ready to use violence to defend himself, his family, and his friends from insult and physical aggression. A few minutes later, I'm sitting on the stoop with Roland, this is still George talking, and his mother, who is chatting with her new friend, Juan, a heroin injector who regularly buys on the block. Roland explains, Juan was the first to hit him. Juan shrugs at Roland. I only went to talk to him at first, but to my eyes, it looked like he was lifting his arm to hit you, so I punched him. Sol adds with pride, see, George, this morning, a man thought I was staring at him, and he cursed me. When he came by again, I pointed him out to Juan. Then, when the trouble started, everybody came out to help me. Roland, noticing my interest, explains, yeah, now, if Juan has problems, I'll ride for him, and for Alfredo, too. I'll do that because they defended my mom. Roland pauses for effect and then speaks slowly. I am Sol's only son. Carlos doesn't fight. He won't get into my mom's problems. So I think God put me here for that reason. If I go to jail or if I die for my mom like this, then I don't care. I will die happy. I'll be smiling in my casket. Roland is currently on probation for 7 counts of possession of narcotics, conspiracy to sell a controlled substance, attempted murder, and gun possession. If he is arrested again on assault, he could face up to 10 years in prison for violating probation. He explains that he was too angry at that moment to worry about his probation status, and he does not regret it, because he feels that having a personal well of rage to draw upon is crucial to being a man. That is why he resents Carlos, his mother's boyfriend, so much. When I get in a fight or I'm really angry, I don't think of anything, and I could kill you. Carlos doesn't have that anger inside him where he can fight. Even if he said, okay, let's fight, and came down to fight someone, he would get his ass kicked, because he doesn't have the anger to fight hard, and the other person will have that anger. I have that anger. Sol nods sadly. I can't depend on Carlos. Carlos is clearly not a rider. and his inability to fight conjugates with a longer list of his other failures as a man that Sol does not hesitate to share with others when she is depressed. Carlos does not contribute financially to the household. He cannot repair things in their crumbling apartment. He does not stop her from resisting the temptations to binge on crack, and he has been sexually impotent for the past 2 years. The importance of being a writer and the type of actions it requires reveal a crucial facet of the moral economy of violence that propels young men and women into violent conflict on inner city streets. It involves reciprocal exchanges of assistive violence and visible displays of honor and aggression. Violence forms part of a larger, morally regulated gift economy of exchanges of goods, services, effective bonds, and even small sums of money in an environment marked by scarcity at the margins of the legal labor market. The term moral economy is most associated with social historians and anthropologists analyzing peasant resistance movements. Most notable is E.P. Thompson's work on food riots and the emergence of working class consciousness in 18th century England, as well as Eric Wolff's comparison of peasant revolutions in the 20th century, and James C. Scott's analysis of peasant resistance and sabotage in Vietnam. And Didier brought it up with conspiracy theories represent a form of moral economy. It's a weapon of the weak in that sense. The analysis of how moral economies mobilize collective action overlaps with Marcel Mauss's 1930s concept of the gift economy in non-state societies outside of or on the margins of the market economy. A gift is never free. It creates a debt that requires future reciprocation. It is the basis of an ongoing relationship, creating durable social bonds and obligations. Successful exchanges over time establish hierarchies of respect and prestige and delineate social network boundaries. Like the exchange of any type of resource, the exchange of violence creates mutual indebtedness and creates durable relationships between exchange partners. Participating in violence becomes both a moral and practical imperative. Failure to engage makes an individual vulnerable to gossip, defamation, social isolation, and ultimately to more violent victimization. As Thomas explained to us, if you're not riding for yourself, I'm not riding with you either, because that means you're not going to ride with me, because you're not riding for yourself. The social vectors of violence generally follow classically patriarchal gender values and kinship responsibilities. Sol, for example, began broadcasting publicly her sexual infidelity to her boyfriend Carlos shortly after he refused to ride for her in that opening episode I described, until she eventually expelled him from her household. To maintain their self-respect, the young men and women growing up on our block must invest a great deal of energy in violence. It is a crucial medium for affirming personal dignity and for anchoring relationships of solidarity. Roland Sol's son, the protagonist who threw the crowning punch on the elderly addict in the opening episode, is unemployed and ineffective in the drug economy, as you can see from his arrest record. He lives as a financial parasite off of his mother with his pregnant 15-year-old girlfriend. In contrast to these failures as a man and as an oldie son, he excels at violence and embraces the opportunity to reaffirm his love for his mother by attacking his mother's insulter. Rather than regretting the risk of long-term incarceration on probation violation, he feels mystically empowered afterwards, referencing God and an epiphanal purpose in life. Participation in the moral economy of violence can also be straightforwardly instrumental. We saw Juan, the upwardly mobile or wannabe upwardly mobile heroin addict, in the first incident, who overeagerly threw the first punch in order to raise his fragile status as a low-status heroin addict by siding with Sol and her son Roland. He was successful. Roland publicly affirmed his new debt to ride for him. Juan's preemptive punch, consequently, now ensures that the same brutality that happened to his victim will not befall him. Alfredo, the 15-year-old, also took advantage of the opportunity to demonstrate his budding masculinity with his kicks, proving himself for the first time in his life to be a worthy rider among adults. Finally, the violence of this moral economy operates as a form of primitive accumulation in the classical Marxist sense of economies organized around slavery, military invasion, or colonial occupation. The capital that is generated, in this case, the social bonds and prestige earned by Roland, Sol, Juan, and Alfredo, are produced through coercion on an unsustainable resource, the bloodied body of a decrepit middle-aged heroin injector. Bourdieu's concept of habitus also helps understand the ease with which people flare up into violence on a daily basis over apparently trivial insults. The moral economy of violence, like other forms of the gift economy, require dispositions of generosity, in this case, dispositions to fight for oneself and for others. For example, Roland, as he explained to George, has an instantly available well of rage that he can draw upon. Both his mother and the elderly addict who was victimized were hypersensitive to imagined or real insults. Juan initiated the beatdown almost as a reflex with a proactive punch to preempt another punch that in fact probably would not have been thrown in the first place. Alfredo, the 15-year-old, had no qualms about repeatedly kicking a fallen, emaciated elderly addict without needing to know why the man deserved punishment. These dispositions and expectations of generosity to protect friends are the and to join friends in their violence are the precondition of robust gift economies, in this case, economies of violence. They become shared social, a shared social common sense affirmed by the actions and affects of the individuals and are upheld by social injunction. It is this common sense, implicit in habitus, formed in conditions of violence with a sensitivity to the particular sort of symbolic capital that violence produces that opens up a space for moral economies of violence. The moral economy of violence plays a very different structural role in its relationship to the larger U.S. society. It buttresses the de facto apartheid boundaries of the U.S. inner city because most people in our country fear that they might be ripped limb from limb if they set foot in the ghetto. It also legitimizes punitive carceral policies. Even though this vision of unworthy, dangerous violence resonates with racially and class-charged fantasies, which themselves are the product of what could be called a disposition to exclude others on the basis of racialized traits that forms part of the habitus of most people in the United States, it is true that the statistical probability of victimization is higher in the segregated and impoverished inner city than it is in wealthy urban neighborhoods. Furthermore, the visible and brutal nature of each incident of interpersonal or criminal violence amplifies the psychological and symbolic consequences of the fear of physical insecurity that prevails among inner city residents and that is irregularly but spectacularly reported on local television news stations. Ironically, however, it's the structural violence of unemployment and infrastructural decay that dominates everyday interactions through the routinized boredom imposed by poverty. The dramatic episodes of interpersonal conflict with which I opened the talk break that frustrating and anxious monotony of poverty and exclusion. Furthermore, when interactions are peaceful, as they are on most days, they are explicitly warm and friendly, consistent with generous dispositions, and consistent with having ample time to kill. Neighbors sit on stoops and organize barbecues for one another, trying to make time pass. Children play in the street because there is absolutely nowhere else for them to go. After-school programs and summer camps do not reach the children on our block. The importance of violence in inner city Philadelphia has a material basis in the need for extra legal enforcement mechanisms to regulate the enormous drug economy. Philadelphia is the poorest large city in the United States, and that city is defined as having populations of over a million. Just under 25% of its residents survive below the poverty line. Philadelphia was renowned as a thriving industrial center throughout the 19th and up through the 1950s. North Philadelphia, where we are working, was the industrial heart of the city. And from our rooftop, this is the view from our rooftop, we can see 14 abandoned factories. The city has suffered population loss every single year from 1950 to 2009, and a higher proportion of its housing stock is abandoned or vacant than that of any other large city in the United States, according to FBI statistics. For three consecutive years, then, we shouldn't be surprised, from 2006 to 2008, that Philadelphia has had the highest violent crime rate among the nation's 10 largest cities. That includes murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. As of the 2000 census, only 27% of the residents of our neighborhood held a high school diploma. Less than 2% had college degrees, and 56% lived below the poverty line. So this area, then, has emerged as Philadelphia and Southern New Jersey's bargain basement open-air drug supermarket. It's an export platform for hundreds of thousands of dollars of narcotics every single day. Given the extreme unemployment levels and the general infrastructural destruction, it's hard to imagine how the local population would survive without this massive daily influx of cash trickling through the neighborhood's small businesses and household-level artisanal markets and unlicensed food sales. Loic Vacon claims that the U.S. unconsciously condones as a structural necessity the concentration of the drug economy in neighborhoods like this as an alternative to having to provide adequate welfare to a population that would otherwise starve, dress in rags, and be left without shelter. As he notes, in America at least, the neoliberal state is not subject to rational design. Public policies result from a mix of leadership intention, bureaucratic groping, I love that, organizational slippage, practical trial and error, and electoral profiteering. The moral economy resonates and arguably even regulates the powerful drug economy. Benito is referred to as the bichote, i.e. the big shot, meaning the owner of our block. All summer, he charged Rico, a local drug entrepreneur, $5,000 a week for the privilege of selling heroin on his corner. And the only way he was able to do it is because everyone's scared of him, because he kills people with great facility. I have little time left. I'm going to just jump to where he lost control of our block. They exchanged some two dozen shots. He was attacked on our block, and he exchanged two dozen shots with his assailant. The only reason why he survived was that his assailant's semi-automatic pistol tangled itself in the pocket of his sagging pants as he was drawing it out because he had attached a longer thing to make the bullets kill, more painfully or whatever. And so his opening salvo went wild, giving Benito enough time to pump four shots into his assailant's back and chest before speeding off in his chauffeured SUV. Now, we counted 12 bullets lodged along six of the houses on our block. What I'm going to do now is just go to an audio account with one of the families that just barely escaped being collateral victims of the shootout. And it gives you a sense, this very short clip, of the moral tone that fuels retaliatory violence that's independent from the original instrumental material motivation of the violence, the original violence, which was a dispute over the control of a profitable drug block. It also tragically reveals the habitus formation imposed on a three-year-old into the logic of a moral economy of violence.
I actually just walked in the door from work. I closed my door, and that's what we experienced. A bunch of gunshots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a bunch of them.
Back here, we'll just shoot. I kill us all.
And then, on this side, you guys are pushing me down. Now it's crying. And that's when I got scared. And my side crying too. She did. Cool. My body fell down. And he just went under the table, and I just threw. And then somebody just knocked their glass down. See? Look.
What is that in the door?
A bully.
A bullet hole.
That's a bullet hole.
Yeah, she hangs out in my room.
No,
she stays in my room now. Because she said she's scared.
Is this the first time something like this happened?
I heard the people are here, so
I'm going to
have to stop.
Stop.
Try to get to a point that one day, I'm going to chuck
it out of
here, have it done in the block.
Thirsty!
It's a common block. They just close right by them, and nothing happens. They don't do nothing. They don't want to do anything. If I select it, if it's not their people, they don't do nothing. concern when Nathan screamed about that. Not more than a woman could be hurt. But she was going to come around and I was going to turn the TV on. But I pushed her, touched her, and I told her, come back, call yourselves. And when I was going to go down, when I went down, soon as I went down, my body hit the street.
It just took off.
Then I felt glad, but glad hit me on the back, and I'm like, whoa.
Here.
And it's about that day, when I don't want to worry your arm, because the next person that I see on my step, I
nice watching out there.
That part right there is going to be, right in my head. You know, I'm going to put on my hands, because I got to think about her. So that happened, and my door got shut. No, I don't want to work.
Okay, so I'm just going to skip to the final set of violence that I want to talk about, moral economy that I want to talk about, which is the police's complex moral economy. When they he referred to it, right? They only take care, they only get active when it's one of them, and they get killed frequently in Philadelphia, and shot at quite frequently in Philadelphia by large city standards. I learned that the hard way because shortly after one of their officers was killed, they had started going on. They go on these low-level police riots after a shooting, and essentially all they do is they just arrest anyone who's suspected of being a drug user and handle them roughly within about a 12-square block of whatever area was arrested. But this got worse because Fox News, by mistake, caught a picture of the cops dragging three young African-American men out of a car and just beating them into the pavement. So I'll just play that, okay, so let's see, where is it? Yeah, this should do it.
Take a look at this disturbing video in Philadelphia. It is a confrontation between Philadelphia police officers and three men, and as you can see, the officers are seen on tape hitting the men with batons and kicking them while they were on the ground. People say they were fleeing, a triple shooting. All three have to be treated at the hospital for their injuries. Philadelphia's police commissioner is asking people not to rush to judgment as they investigate the arrest, but the amount of force they take doesn't look good for officers.
So all the officers were acquitted, by the way, and none of the three kids that they dragged out of the car were actually involved in the shooting. It came out later. But what I didn't understand was, this was the early moment, this was just to end with the moral economy. There had just been a new commissioner, and he actually fired several of the officers. They all got reinstated because the union has supervisory rights over all sanctions in Philadelphia. And so the cops were furious about having been caught with their pants down. And I didn't know that you're supposed to stay off the streets after dark when that happens. And they caught me handcuffed, threw me on the ground, handcuffed me, and fractured my ribs, and put me in jail for 18 hours with false accusations. So, that's just a trivial minor routine of that dynamic. So what takes place then are these multiple logics for violence, some of them instrumental, some of them directly in the gift economy that leads to these crises. And the one other thing I actually did have a concrete applied policy thing, and I was describing another. The guy, by the way, it's not good news, but the guy who shot the other guy in the four backs, well, he's now in the hospital with four shots to his stomach because they reattacked him, but this time with semi-automatic rifles, not pistols. The cops describe what they caught in the car. It's this. I put away the thing. It's this. I mean, it's just this ridiculous litany of AK-47. This, that. Drew Young knows all the names of those guns. But the concrete applied thing is like, get some gun laws, stupid. It's just so incredibly absurd within this context that this neighborhood is literally being flooded with extraordinarily cheap guns that are very, very easy to get. Okay. And instead we do behavior action knowledge or behavior attitudes knowledge interventions. Okay. Please.